A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, Radio Netherlands Weekly Communications Review with Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and we start with a quick quiz. Have a listen to these two voices from the past.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender Hamburg, station Bremen, and station DXB on the 31-meter band. You are about to hear our news in English.
Remember, I am liberty. I shall be back. Keep waiting for me. At the world looking when I will come in.
Now, why are those two different from these next two voices?
This is the voice of Vietnam, broadcasting from Hanoi to American servicemen involved in the Vietnam War.
This is after her weekend, Annie, back on the air strictly under UN hours. Is Epson okay? Well, it better be, because this is all request night. And I've got a pretty nice program for my favorite little family.
Well, all the voices you've heard were broadcast during times of conflict. In the Second World War, pro-Nazi William Joyce broadcast from Berlin for listeners in Britain. He was quickly given the name Lord Haw-Haw. More recently, in May of 1982, a popular television presenter in Buenos Aires, Argentina, was hired to broadcast sweet messages to the UK task force on its way to regain the Falkland Islands. The newspapers in Britain referred to her as Argentine Annie, although a transmitter fault made it very difficult to understand exactly what she was saying. Both those voices were always one person. In fact, it was because an Allied soldier recognised William Joyce's voice after the war that Lord Haw-Haw was later hanged for treason by the British. But now to the other group. During the Vietnam War, the Voice of Vietnam in Hanoi had several daily broadcasts to American soldiers fighting in the South. The female announcers never gave their name, but the GIs had one. Remember the film Good Morning Vietnam a few years back, portraying the armed forces broadcaster Adrian Cronauer, stationed in Saigon.
What is a demilitarized zone? Sounds like something out of the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, no, don't go in there.
Oh, hee-ho, Ho Chi Minh.
Oh, look, you've landed in Saigon. You're among the little people now.
We represent the Arvern Army, the Arvern Army. Oh, no, follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Oh, I'll get you, my pretty! Oh, my God, it's a wicked witch of the north. It's Hanoi Hannah! Now, little G.I., you and your little toodoo, too!
In fact, Hanoi Hannah was just a name given by the American military to any female voice out of Hanoi. In fact, history had repeated itself, because during the Second World War, the female voices on Radio Tokyo were given a similar nickname, Tokyo Rose. In 1945, the US Paramount Film Company made a film called Tokyo Rose, starring the glamorous Lotus Long. And in July 47, Abe Burrows sang this ode to the broadcaster.
I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you've done. I'll bet you're sorry that you went to work for that old rising sun. You stuck a knife into the USA. You forgot what they learned you at UCLA. I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you... Sorry for what you've done.
British-born author Russell Warren Howe now lives in Washington, D.C. in the United States. He's written a book about Mata Hari, which he describes as a perfect example of a miscarriage of justice. And now he's just come out with a book on another case of a deliberate frame-up, the prosecution by the United States of Eva Toguri for being Tokyo Rose. In fact, she was only one of the many female voices on the transmitters of the Imperial Japanese Empire in the early 1940s.
There were 27 Japanese-American or Japanese-Canadian or Anglo-Japanese females broadcasting on various Japanese radios in the Pacific, not only Tokyo. Some of them were undoubtedly broadcasting propaganda, although nothing that seems to conform to the legend of somebody deliberately sort of constantly announcing attacks just before they took place, which it wouldn't make much sense to do from a military point of view, trying to lower morale and so on and so forth. But, of course, the person who was actually arrested for that was just a disc jockey.
This is Shigeo Hour calling in the Pacific. And for the next 75 minutes, we're going to take you through music as you like it, blues and hearts and otherwise. News from all over the world and a thought for the day.
So who were these announcers on Radio Tokyo's English service behind the so-called Zero Hour programme?
Well, they all belong to Nikon Hoso Keikai, which is the Japanese national radio, and they were the result of the spread of the Japanese Empire, so they went all the way up to Korea and down to the Philippines and into China. They were in various islands in the Pacific. They were in Burma, for instance. They were in 13 different places in all. And I guess the power and strength of the station varied considerably from one place to another, and the programs must have been to some degree different, but to some degree the same. I would imagine that all the news programs were the same. They would not necessarily be broadcast at the same hour because different time zones were involved. But the major one was out of Tokyo itself.
And all these regional stations, as well as having programs obviously in Japanese, must have had programs in English directed at what they saw as the enemy.
Yes, a great many of them had programs in English, yeah. And they all would have had programs in local languages like Chinese, other than just Japanese. There would be programs also for the Japanese forces, but the propaganda programs were essentially, of course, for the enemy or for the occupied.
Okay, let's focus more on Radio Tokyo, as it was called in those days. How did they get the broadcasters? Were they Japanese that were simply learned English?
The broadcasters in English were all Japanese-Americans, Anglo-Japanese, Japanese-Canadians, and they were all people who were... Well, in the case of the girls, they were nearly all stranded there at the time of the war. There were Japanese-Americans, Nisei, born in California, for instance, who had gone back because of the difficulty of getting jobs in America, the difficulty of entering universities, the prejudice against Asians, and some had gone back there with the intention of rebuilding their career in their father's country rather than in their own. Some of these people were entirely devoted to the Japanese cause. But the girls, for the most part, were just earning a living. They were people who were stranded there by the outbreak of war, stranded by Pearl Harbor.
But as well as the Japanese-Americans or Japanese-Canadians, there were also people who were rather drafted in against their will.
Yes, well, there was this fact that the Japanese were not used to the idea of prisoners of war. The principle was not part of Japanese culture, and especially officers were expected to shoot themselves rather than surrender. And they suddenly had these enormous numbers of people on their hands who had to be fed and guarded and were costly, in other words. And one of the ways they tried to turn this to advantage was they deliberately sought out those who had a radio background, and they brought them to Tokyo, and they put them in a former girls' school called Suragarai, which the prisoners called Bunker Camp. And these people were there. They were, I called them in the book Radio Slaves. They were there solely for the purpose of producing radio programs. And the most important of them was an Australian major, Charles, whose cousin, who had been the Richard Dimbleby of Australian radio before World War II. He was called the Golden Voice of Australian radio. And he was a fellow with a Sandhurst background who had served in the Indian Army. And at the time of Dunkirk, he had volunteered to go back into the army, and he had been captured as a major at Singapore. And when they realized they had a very experienced radio person on their hands, he was privileged to be flown to Tokyo. All the others were dumped in a ship, but he was flown there, which is, even for the Japanese, you had to be at least a colonel or a general to be put on a plane in those days. And he was given the instructions of starting a program, and he managed very skillfully to do as little as possible and to sabotage wherever possible. And then the program, they called for an expansion of the program and to include a music program. And he decided that the easiest way to tackle this would be to have a female disc jockey, so that it would be unlikely that the Japanese would think of announcing propaganda through a woman, because they wouldn't expect anyone to believe it. And he would make it as innocuous as possible. And he selected Iva Toguri, the person who was later convicted as Tokyo Rose, because she was the most loyal.
Loyal to him?
Well, loyal to the United States. She was the only one who had refused to take Japanese citizenship, and this became a problem after the war, because she was the only one who could literally be accused of treason, because the others had a dual nationality. But he also chose her because she had an absolutely terrible voice. It was variously described as like a hacksaw, like a crow, like Gracie Allen, and he figured that if she did have to say anything, even on a disc jockey program, it was propagandistic, he could manage to make her burlesque what she was doing. And in fact, the whole program was a burlesque. It's really quite funny, and it's almost skillful. It was a very burlesque program. It was meant to make the GIs laugh at Japanese radio.
Hello and hello to you fighting orphans in the Pacific waters. This is your playmate, Orphan Man, taking roll call on a Tuesday evening. All the rifles see you, boys, and how's that do tonight?
Now, who wrote the script?
Well, Charles Cousins wrote the script, and he coached her on how to read it. He said, I want you to sound jolly. You must sound like a female army officer ordering the troops to be jolly. And the whole thing was it was a little private war. They couldn't get out of doing something, and so they tried what they could to sabotage it. And there were two other officers also involved in writing and producing. One was an American lieutenant called Ted Ince, and the other was a Filipino third lieutenant called Normando Reyes. These were the three who worked on the program. They were all officer prisoners of war, and they were all at Surigadai camp.
And did they all sabotage the program to the same degree?
Well, those three were all in a conspiracy with Iva Toguri. But they didn't talk about much to others, and she never talked about to anyone else, because there were spies in the program, and even some of the Japanese-American women who were in it were not particularly pro-American, and some of them had Japanese boyfriends and so on and so forth. And by and large, the easiest way to continue to be effective was to tell as few people as possible.
So they weren't responsible for the whole output of Radio Tokyo?
Oh, no. Well, Charles Cousins was only responsible for one or two programs, and the program that Iva Toguri did was a daily 20-minute disc jockey program, and it went on for just over a year, but she was absent for long periods of time. She used many excuses. On one occasion, she was away for 3 months. She would say she was sick, or that the American bombing raids made it impossible to come to the station, and for one reason or another, I would think that at a guess of those 15 months... she was on the air about half the time on average.
And that was a man who remembers five of those heads of curly hair, Eddie Tanker. And with that, we call a day a day. I have to remember those union hours. And I don't see Betty around today. Maybe she took the hint about the man through the union. It's darn good, huh? So time for farewells again, my orphans, but remember...
Orphan Ann sounds a strange name. How on earth did she get the name?
When the script was written, where she had to read her part, they had typed in ANN for announcer. And once, by mistake, she read the Ann. And so they said, well, let's make that your name. And then because the Australians called themselves the Orphans of the Pacific, the ones that would get stranded on islands, Charles Cousins changed this to Orphan Annie, and then Int said, well, we've got a character like that, a strip cartoon character called Orphan Annie, so they changed it to Orphan Annie. But the whole program was called Zero Hour, and that was an invention of the Nisei Japanese-American man who ran it, who was a loyal to Japan, who had definitely changed his allegiance, who was disgusted with the United States and had gone back to Japan to find a career.
Mind you, it does seem rather funny that the Japanese themselves didn't spot what was going on.
It does, in a way, and there was always a fear that that what they were doing would be reported in the American press, and then they would be in trouble.
I saw you standing in the sun, and you were something to see. I know what I like, and I liked what I saw, and I said to myself, that's for me.
But what was Iva Turgary doing in Japan at the outbreak of the Second World War?
Well, she went to Japan a few months before the outbreak of war because her mother's sister, her aunt, who was a diabetic, appeared to be dying. And her mother was also, Iva Turgary's mother was also a diabetic. The sister had really wanted her sister to come home and visit her for the last time. And since Iva's mother couldn't go and Iva's father couldn't leave the store and he needed the boys there, and Iva Turgary had just graduated with a degree in biology, and she wasn't absolutely necessary in the store, and she wasn't actually working at the time, and she was the senior daughter, it would seem the obvious person to send to be at Aunt Shizu's bedside. And so she went back to live there for... She was going to live for about a year if her aunt lasted that long, and then her father was going to visit the following year and take her home. Just before Pearl Harbor broke out, she began to realize, even though she couldn't read the Japanese press, that the situation between the United States and Japan was getting very bad. And so she telephoned her father, and he arranged passage for her on a ship. And she was unable to get all the papers necessary for exiting from Japan in time, but in any event, Pearl Harbor took place and the ship turned back. She would never have made it anyway. She was offered passage on a later ship on the Gripsholm, the Swedish ship which did a lot of mercy journeys during the war, and that would have taken the Americans to Goa, which was a Portuguese enclave in India then, and they could have made their way from there, but by then she had run out of money. The Japanese, of course, were living in very harsh conditions themselves at the time. There was a blockade which had been going on since the way back into the 30s, and they were short of food. And since she refused to take citizenship, she couldn't have a ration card. She was frequently sick from starvation and beriberi and scurvy and things like this, and poor state of health generally. And all this cost money. She was in and out of hospital. So basically, she took a job with the news agency, which was then called Dome. And there she got into trouble because of her pro-American opinions, and she had to leave. And she then found this job at a Japanese radio, and which paid almost as much for much less work. And then she found another job as the typist at the Danish legation. And if you recall, during World War II, Germany never actually occupied Denmark. They used it as a source of agriculture, and in Britain it was agreed not to bomb Denmark because of this. And because of that, Denmark was not theoretically at war, and so it still had a consulate in Tokyo. So she had these two jobs. The most important one, obviously, was at the consulate. And she was sort of moonlighting, as it were, at Nihon Hoso Kekai in the evening to do this program.
When the war in the Pacific ended, Radio Tokyo simply disappeared from the airwaves. But the broadcasts still lived on in the memory of the American military. The U.S. 1st Marine Division composed a reply to the wartime programs in the form of a love note.
Dear Tokyo Rose, because for so many, many months now you've entertained the Marine Corps in general and the 1st Division in particular, we feel that the only gentlemanly thing to do is return the compliment. So we have a little number we're going to play tonight dedicated just to you. But first, Rosie. In regard to those cracks you've been making, that the folks back home will forget about us out here in the Pacific when Germany surrenders. Rosie, I'm surprised at you. You know, ordinarily you're a pretty smart propagandist, but this time you've certainly missed the boat. Why?
Iva Turgary thought that by playing music and giving a bit of idle chatter, she'd help the GIs by boosting morale. And it was that belief that led her into serious trouble.
American correspondents came in, and they all wanted to interview Admiral Tojo, which, of course, was impossible, or
MacArthur, which was almost equally difficult and so on. But I mean, the sort of final fallback, if you couldn't get anybody else, was find Tokyo Rose and interview her, because everybody loves Tokyo Rose, you know, he's a famous character. And Iva Toguri made the enormous mistake of volunteering and saying she was Tokyo Rose.
For money?
Yes, for money. She was under the impression that Tokyo Rose was a sort of GI sweetheart, which up to a point she was. Nobody really thought of this as a very serious program anyway. Even the other, even though what the GIs thought of as Tokyo Rose was a sort of mélange of many different people. But because the GIs couldn't tell the difference between one woman speaking with a Japanese accent and another, or even speaking with a Filipino accent or some other accent, they all sounded like one woman to them. There were two correspondents of the Hearst Empire, and they set out to find her, and various names were suggested, and her name was one of them, and she volunteered and said that, yes, okay, she was Tokyo Rose, and she was prepared to sign autographs as Tokyo Rose and so on and so forth. So she walked straight into it.
On August 4th, 1947, the U.S. Mutual Network carried one of many short interviews.
Tokyo Rose was a stooge of Japanese psychological warfare. Actually, there were seven such girls, but today, 2 years after VJ Day, Iva Toguri, the California-born and educated Nisei, is still around Tokyo, living in a hovel outside the capital, seeking only to be forgotten as the Japanese want to forget. 10 days ago, she had this to say to Burton Crane, mutual correspondent.
I'm one of those persons who hope that we can forget the past, and I have a lot of it to forget, and concentrate on the future.
She was arrested because she had said she was Tokyo Rose. She was virtually held incommunicado for 2 or 3 months, and even though she was a U.S. citizen, she was treated as a Japanese for reasons of diet and bedding and that type of thing. And for that reason, she wasn't allowed visitors or a lawyer or anything. And after a year, she was released from Sugamo prison because they realized there was no case. The attorney general ordered her released. She had, in the latter stages of the war, had married a part Portuguese, part Asian, part Japanese, in other words, a Eurasian, Felipe, and he said, well, why don't we just keep quiet for a while until the whole thing dies down? But she had a very typically American attitude that she had her rights and she'd been vindicated and she wanted her passport back and she wanted to go home. And someone, very probably J. Edgar Hoover himself at the FBI, leaked the news to the Walter Winchell column that Tokyo Rose was coming back to California.
Who's Walter Winchell? He was a famous journalist, was he?
Yeah, Walter Winchell was one of the worst journalists to ever live, but probably one of the most famous columnists at the time, maybe the most famous columnist. And he was also on radio, which, of course, there was no television then, so he was really all over the world. And he was a great friend of J. Edgar Hoover, and Hoover used to leak him stories, and then he would tell the great story of the FBI and help them when budget time came around.
You say he was the worst journalist. You mean he just made things up?
Yeah, there was a film about him called The Harder They Fall with Burt Lancaster about 20 years ago. He just terrorized people.
So he started making publicity that Tokyo Rose was coming home, as it were.
Right, and, you know, there was this person who had been making fun of, teasing American soldiers and announcing bombing raids just before they happened to terrorize them and so on. And as I said, all she was doing was a 20-minute disc jockey program, but most of it was... most of it was English music because they knew the GIs wouldn't like that very much. They were doing things like Kotelbys in a Persian garden and ballads and piano accordion music, everything that would make the GIs laugh at how the Japanese didn't know how to run a program for them.
So she arrived back in the United States. Did the FBI then start investigating her further?
No, she was rearrested on the strength of the Winchell campaign. The American Legion, various other people were calling for her rearrest, and so she was rearrested and reinvestigated and then brought back to stand trial in San Francisco. The law says that when someone is brought back from overseas, extradited to stand trial, he or she stands trial in the first American jurisdiction in which they arrive. In those days, all the troop ships stopped at Hawaii, and it was feared that she might get a favorable jury in Hawaii. And those days, curiously enough, it's very different today, but San Francisco was the most anti-Oriental city. Today, it's 38% Asian in population. But they figured that it would be easier to get an anti-Tokyo Rose jury in San Francisco than in our hometown as Los Angeles. There was thought at one time of flying her across Canada and landing her in New York to get an anti-Asian jury. But anyway, she ended up and she got she didn't get an anti-Asian jury, she got a very anti-Asian judge, an Irish Nisei, a sort of second-generation Irish-American, who clearly had very strong feelings against her all through the trial. But the people who had managed the programs were the two principal perjury witnesses, Mitsushio and Oki, whom I interviewed in Tokyo, and both of whom confessed to perjury. And they were told that unless they gave evidence in a certain way, they would be put on trial for treason. And they gave absolutely cloned evidence, and in the book I have shown, but putting one page beside the other, they both theoretically said exactly the same thing, which is totally impossible. But, and that's because treason is the only crime which is defined in the Constitution, and it requires, there has the biblical requirement of two witnesses to an overt act for every offense. And so they had to have two witnesses, and these two gave absolutely identical evidence. I also interviewed the FBI agent who persuaded them to do this, who is now in his 80s also, but still perfectly lucid. It was a frame-up, completely a frame-up to make sure that they would win a prosecution.
The jury had difficulty making a decision. Half thought she was guilty, the other half innocent. The judge kept sending them back for a unanimous decision.
And finally, they worked out a compromise, as juries often do, which is one of the reasons why juries have been abolished in most countries. It was agreed between those who thought she was innocent and those who thought she was guilty that they would find her innocent of 7 counts and guilty of one of the minor counts, because they reasoned, wrongly as it turned out, that since she had then spent 2 years in prison in Japan and in San Francisco, the judge would not ask her to do any more time. But in point of fact, he gave her 10 years and a $50,000 fine, which is the equivalent today of about $500,000 in fine. You know.
She did 8 years and 2 months in confinement in all, and then she returned to Chicago to run her late father's store, which sells everything from Thai fish sauce to Japanese video cassettes. But after her ordeal, does Iva Toghri bear any grudge against the American people?
She says not. She became a Catholic in order to marry Felipe, and her religion has been a great source of relief and to her, and as she said, stopped her going crazy in jail. But she's rather cantankerous. I mean, she's still a rather chippy old lady and very wary, very worried now about becoming famous again. She's always afraid that someone will throw a bomb in the store, that some equally elderly loony from the Pacific War will still believe that she's the enemy. And, of course, all this is possible. But her life was completely ruined. She was in such a state of nerves shortly before her arrest that in Tokyo, that when a second arrest, that is, that when her child was born, it only lived for one day, and then her husband was not allowed to come to the United States, and so it broke the marriage, it broke everything. I mean, it destroyed her entire life, this disc jockey program. But if you're to come back to the question of propaganda on radio, there were some genuine propagandists there. They were mostly men. Charles Yoshi, for instance, who was a graduate of an American university and a Japanese-American, who broadcast editorials. There was a civilian called Mark Streeter, who was fiercely anti-Roosevelt and who was so much so that they had to put him in a separate prison camp because he wasn't safe from the other prisoners. And there was a beauty queen in Manila who was a really sexy disc jockey and who was living with the Japanese who ran the program. And I mean, all these people could theoretically have been accused of the same sort of thing, and they, you know, but Iva Toghri was virtually the least guilty.
She has now been pardoned, though, hasn't she?
Gerald Ford, on his last day in office in January 1977, pardoned her, but a pardon is not innocence, it's forgiveness for guilt. It means that you've suffered enough, and it gives you back your voting rights and your passport and all that sort of thing. So what I have asked three people in Congress, her two senators and her congressman, to do is to put through a resolution of the joint houses of Congress of a national apology to her, because it's much too late for a retrial. Most of the witnesses are dead. She herself would not want to go through it. There's no question of a retrial. But a national apology from the Congress would be as good as an acquittal.
How old is she now, roughly?
She'll be 74 on, of all days, the 4th of July, the national holiday.
If you're interested in knowing far more background than we've had time to discuss, you might like to read Russell Warren Howe's book. It's called The Hunt for Tokyo Rose, and it's published by Madison Books of Langham, Maryland, in the United States. The title again, The Hunt for Tokyo Rose. The cover price in hardback is $19.95. I'd also like to thank Norman Shrine of Dayton, Ohio, for help with the Hanoi Hannah recording you heard earlier. That's it for now. We hope to be back with a news-orientated programme next week. In the meantime, take care and have an enjoyable weekend.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static, some people get far-off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 ident and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues, and a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxr.ca. Good listening, everyone.